Tonight's my pleasure to introduce our guest speaker, Mr. Paul Graham. Mr. Graham is a native of Columbia, South Carolina. He holds a bachelor's degree and master's degree in psychology or philosophy from the University of South Carolina. He is a past president of the South Carolina Masonic Research and the former editor of the Palmetto Partisan, the official journal of the South Carolina Division of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. He is a member of the Lieutenant General Wade Hampton Camp in Columbia. Mr. Graham's writings have appeared in several publications, including the Sens Review, the Palmetto Partisan, and the Transactions of the South Carolina Masonic Society, and the Abbeville Institute's Blog and Review. Mr. Graham resides in Casey, South Carolina, with his beautiful bride of nearly 20 years, Miss Suzette. Tonight, Mr. Graham will speak on his most recent book, When the Yankees Came, Former South Carolina Slaves Remember Sherman's Invasion. Mr. Graham.
Thank you. How y'all doing? I got all my stuff hid down here. That was a really, really big piece of cake. It really was. And I appreciate it. Boy, I'm feeling it. Got my lips red, my teeth blue. The reason I brought this up here is because I got a story to tell you before I start the presentation. Now, there was a young boy at State Park, and a dog got loose and attacked the boy. And this man ran up, snatched up the dog, threw it down, killed it. And there was a reporter from Mr. Dill's outfit, the Times Examiner, there, and he ran up and said he's going to do a story on this hero. He says, I think I'll use the title like Local Man Saves Child from Vicious Beast. And then the man said, well, I'm not from Greenville. He says, oh. Well, we'll say South Carolina Man Saves Boy from Dog. He said, well, I'm not from South Carolina. And the reporter said, well, where are you from? He said, Boston. He said, well, we're going to call that Yankee Kills Boy's Pet. So I'm really lucky to have this newspaper come here, because I was going to have to pick somewhere out of the way. I didn't realize that this is where the good newspaper was, because I knew I was going to use the other one as an example. Okay, the topic I'm going to get into this evening, I think, is rather interesting. And when I first started putting it together, well, first let me thank Mr. Brother Amos for inviting me, and for Commander Smith allowing me to be here, for all of you for inviting me out and treating me so well. So, to continue, when I first prepared these remarks, I had almost sort of an academic setup, you know, where you want to set up the problem, and I was going to say something about the word invasion, and how invasion doesn't cause secession. Invasion was the word that was most likely used by most people when they came through South Carolina. And I was going to waylay that into that and then go into the slave narratives. But on the way down, I decided that was going to be probably not the best way to do it, to make the topic too sterile. So I'm going to try something different, sort of in a little experiment to help set this thing up and set the tone for the presentation. And I'm going to ask for a volunteer. But who I really want is Mr. Dill. You can put that down. All right. Now, these are very simple questions. If you don't need to answer them out loud, just say if you could give the answer, yeah, just whether or not you could give an answer. Okay. Do you remember where you were on 9/11?
Yeah.
If you had to write down a description of that day, could you do it? I'm not asking you to do it, but could you?
Yeah.
Okay. How about, do you remember your favorite teacher in elementary school? Or your least favorite one? One that you either loved or hated?
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you were to, you could probably sit down and write down why you liked him or didn't like him either. Couldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Now, if you wrote down your answers and put them in storage, and someone read them 80 years later, would you say that the information would still be accurate?
Yeah,
I think so too. The passage of time would not change the facts, right? Do you or does anyone in the room think that Mr. Gill needs some kind of special training or advanced degree in history, sociology, psychology, or political science to speak authoritatively about his experience on these different times in his life? I wouldn't think so. Do you think that if someone 80 years from now and we're gone, well, probably, except for probably some of the young ones, do you think that anyone would need special training to be able to read what he had written and understand it? I don't think so either. I don't think so either. Either if it was 80 years from now, 100 years from now, 200 years from now, I think that the authority of Mr. Gill's experience is enough for him to speak about his own life. And secondly, that anyone who picks it up and reads it has sufficient training in their own personal lives to be able to read it without even going to college and getting degrees and all that business. So the point I'm trying to make is, Mr. Gill and all of us have things in our life that we remember. We can write them down, and we could bury them or put them in a vault or whatever, and they would still be true no matter how long time passed, and they wouldn't be all that difficult to decipher. Mr. Gill's humanity is enough to speak authoritatively of his own experience. It's enough for him to have actually experienced it. We don't need anything else. And that's all he needs to speak authoritatively of his own experience. And there's no reason for us to think that he needs anything more. Now, in the book that I edited that I'm going to talk about this evening, called When the Yankees Come, Former South Carolina Slaves Remember Servants Invasion, we have the accounts of people just like us, people who had experiences, and just like all of us, we can listen to them with as much confidence as we can with anybody else in this room, recounting their own experiences, particularly if it was a hard or traumatic experience. Those are the ones we seem to remember more. And so the only difference between what we may write down and what they would have written down or had written down for them, as the case may be, is that we could go and talk to the original source right now, whereas in 80 years we can't. And that's the only difference. Human beings. They were human beings. So, how did I end up doing this project? It's kind of a long way around to get to it, but I think it's worth mentioning before we get down into the nitty-gritty of the affair. Back in 2015, y'all might remember the sesquicentennial, towards the end of the war, okay? Well, as a native of Colombia, they had a commemoration of the event. They called it a commemoration, or remembering, but there was actually very little about the event that had anything to do with the burning of Columbia. And that's hard to believe. It's true. They barely acknowledged the burning. They're more interested in considering other topics. such as slavery and the civil rights movement. And I thought perhaps, given the circumstances of the 150th anniversary of the burning of the city, that Columbia might step up to the plate and actually look at what happened. There's not really any markers or monuments there other than a couple of plaques, maybe one plaque on the State House ground where the old State House used to be, and there's a little piece on the side of one bank that acknowledges that what was once there at one time. But there's really nothing in Columbia that would indicate that it was ever burned to the ground. And that doesn't surprise me, or it shouldn't surprise me, because if you were to go to Columbia's official website, Columbia, South Carolina's official city website, and read the history of Columbia, you would not find any mention of the burning of Columbia. You wouldn't hear any mention of the war. Actually, for them, nothing happened between the years 1854 and 1780. Not one damn thing. And you don't believe me? I pulled this up yesterday. I'm going to read this paragraph. This is the last paragraph for the 1800s. Columbia became chartered in 1854 with an elected mayor and six aldermen. 2 years later, they had a police force consisting of a full-time chief and 9 patrolmen. The salary of the patrolmen was $16 a month. Very interesting. Abraham Blanding, the town's first school teacher and attorney, built Columbia's first waterworks, pumping water with steam engine into a wooden tank, which was carried by cast iron and lead pipes to the homes and businesses in the area. The city purchased the system from Blanding at a third of its investment in 1835. As a tribute to Blanding, the town council later changed the name of Walnut Street to Blanding Street. Growth continued with the first annex of the suburbs in 1870. I'm not kidding. This is their official website. Okay? So, which brings me to sort of an anecdotal item that's going to eventually work its way back to the slave narratives. I was born and raised in Columbia, South Carolina. I was born in the Providence Hospital there. I think it's the last year that we lived with children there. I went to K through 12 public schools, and I went to college in Columbia. I went to the University of South Carolina, Columbia twice. And I never knew that the city of my birth had been burned to the ground. I had no knowledge of the burning of Columbia until I was in graduate school. Now, when I was in grade school, we went to the State House. They pointed out the stars on the side of the State House where the cannonballs had hit, and they pointed out, you know, the cane that George Washington was holding. It had been knocked, you know, brick-batted by Yankee soldiers, but nobody talked about the burning of Columbia. And I didn't know anything about it. When I was in graduate school, a friend of mine was doing his senior thesis paper in history on General Sherman. I was studying philosophy at the time, and the Civil War, which is what I would have called it at the time, was not really a topic of interest to me, but he was a friend of mine, he was working on it, he was very excited about it, so I read it. And one of the major sources of the paper that he used was William Gilmore Sims' Sack of Destruction of Columbia, which I'm sure you all are familiar with. So after I finished reading his paper, I said, well, this sounds pretty big. So I went to the Sims account, which I had never read before, and I couldn't believe what I was reading. It had a profound effect on me. And let me read what I wrote about it in here. What was even more shocking than the horrific details of the affair was that the devastation was inflicted by the Army of the United States of America. This ran contrary to everything I had been taught and at the time believed about my country, yet there it was, theft, vandalism, arson, rape, and murder. All perpetrated by Union troops, not by some faraway land, not in some faraway land, excuse me, but in my own backyard. Not against a foreign army, but against my own people, my own family. There were not people who deserved it or had it coming. There were people that I knew to be decent and God-fearing. I had always known that I had Confederates in the closet, but I had always considered myself to be a proud American. This, however, shook me to the core. I was not proud of this. I was angry. So, let's circle back around to Columbia again. Because there was such an interest in slavery and such a small interest in what actually happened in Columbia, I thought it might be interesting to explore what actual people who had actually been slaves had to say about the actual experience of the Yankee invasion. You know, because you can't trust Rebs to tell the truth, I thought I'd just go around those Rebs and see what the other folks were saying, right? Can't trust them, they all lie. It's that lost cause mythology that we suffer from. So, anyway, I went to the slave narratives, and my sole concern was to ferret out anything that they said in the interviews, and I'll just talk a little bit more about that in a second, regarding any interaction they had with Union troops. That's all I pulled out of it. Okay? That's it. Now, whether it was one sentence or a paragraph or a half a page, if it mentioned the Union troops or any interaction with them, whether good, bad, or indifferent, it was going to be in this book, and I pulled everything up. And I didn't hold anything back. Now, let me tell you what the narratives are, just so we can be straight about where these source materials come from and what they are. They were part of the Writers, Federal Writers Project, which is one of the many New Deal projects enacted during the Great Depression under the WPA, or Works Progress Administration, under the FDR administration. Can you hand my coffee or water? That coffee on the corner too. I apologize. I was so interested to bring my prop up here, but I forgot to bring something. Okay. Now, what is the scope of the work? 17 states. The slave narratives consist of 17 states, 10,000 type pages, and over 2,000 interviews. They're organized by state. Each state has their own different section in the larger work, and the South Carolina narratives take up 4 full volumes. So if you've ever been in a store or bookstore or looking on Amazon or something, and you see a book called The Slave Narratives, I can promise you that's not what it is. It may be something similar to what I did, but usually they cherry pick the ugly parts, and there's plenty of ugly parts in there. So we're talking about a massive, massive work. South Carolina by itself, 4 volumes. The interviews took place during 1936 and 37, mostly 1936. And just to give you sort of an overview of what I found, I'll give you a little statistical breakdown of that I put together. Out of the 4 volumes, 40% of all the people who were interviewed mentioned the Yankees. Of those 40%, 38% reported theft. 11% reported vandalism. And by vandalism, I mean destruction of property that did not end in arson. 38% reported arson. 9% reported slaughter of livestock and destruction of foodstuffs. That is, neither taken nor consumed by Union armies and was not edible to those left behind. Which is pretty incredible. You're talking about a 100-mile swath through the middle of the city. 40% had something to say. It would have been nice if they had conducted these interviews 30 years earlier, 40 years, or 50 years, or 60 years earlier. But this is what we've got. This is what we've got. Now, these accounts are considered suspect by the academic community. Respectable historians generally take them with a grain of salt. You know what respectable historians are, don't you? They're the ones that think that everything we say is wrong. So if we're wrong, they're respected, right? That's how you define them. Anti-Confederate, anti-Southern, that's respectful. That's how they define them. But what happens if you take the source material and lay it against other source material of people who were there and lay it against the other interviewees in the same work? You know, if someone's in Spartanburg or someone's in Fairfield County or Richland County or down below country, what if all their accounts seem to have the same characteristics? Well, it's not so easy to dismiss it. The metaphor I like to use is a mosaic, which is an image put together with little pieces of tile. And just like a mosaic, any one piece of tile is not going to really tell you much about the picture, right? Just like we can pick any one account out of the slave narrative, it's not going to tell us a whole lot, and we're not going to really be able to walk away with a lot. We have to assume that the person was telling the truth, and we have to assume that this was characteristic of the larger affair. But the more tiles that you have, and the more tiles that are laid down next to each other, an image begins to emerge. And that's exactly what happens here. Thankfully, there are a few more positive accounts. There's several positive accounts, or at least not negative accounts, of the interaction between the Yankee soldiers and the former South Carolina slaves, but it's a vast, vast majority of them were not. I'll read all of them. I think I've got three out of the whole collection. Three, okay, they were okay, or they didn't treat us too bad. So I need to give you a little note on how I handled the material. Textual characteristics and treatment. If anyone's ever looked at the dialogues that are written in dialect, they're spelled phonetically to preserve the way that they spoke. Now, I can read it just fine. Probably most of y'all can read it just fine. But probably people that are not from around these here parts can't read it very well, okay? So what I did was very simple. I took the dialect, and I changed the spelling to match what we would normally use in spelling. So if they say thee, I change it to thee. If they said them, I change it to them. And that's all I did. The words are the same. Everything's the same. Because my point was not to clean them up or change the words in any way or fashion, but it's more important, at least in this context, what they said as opposed to how they said it. I can understand why people want to do that, but you know, if I wanted anyone to be able to get to the material, I had to change it up just a little bit. The words are the same. The spelling has been changed. That's it. Now, I have put down exactly what they have said, and I have not censored it for sensitive 21st century ears. This is your trigger warning. all you delicate flowers and snowflakes out there, this is not a safe space. You have been warned, do not shoot the messenger. I don't think it was my business, my prerogative, to tell these people how they shouldn't or shouldn't speak about their own lives. And I've done it, and I won't. So, let's check it out. Let's start with one. I got several more, but we'll go to a few of them. Y'all want to hear one that's positive about the Yankees? I got one.
Not really.
I want to be fair and balanced. Okay, well, here's one of the three. It's one sentence from Washington Dozier in Marion County. The Yankees come through here, and to my knowledge, they behave very well. That's it. That's all I had to say. Let's see what someone else had to say. John C. Brown, near Woodward, Fairfield County. The Yankees come. That's why I call it the Yankees come, because they seem to all say that when they start. The Yankees come and burnt the mansion, the gin house and the mill. They take all the sheep, mules, hogs, and even the chicken. Set the slaves free, and us niggers had a hard time ever since. Donna Cunningham, near Ridgeway, Fairfield County. When the Yankees come, they went through the big house, tore up everything, ripped open the feather beds and the cotton mattresses, searched for all the money and jewels. They had us slaves to catch the chickens, flung open the smokehouse, take the meat, mill flour, and put them in four-horse wagon, and they went down Longtown. Them was scandalous day, boss. I hope never see the likes of them times with these old eyes. Lewis Evans. The Yankees come. First thing they looked for was money. Then they put a pistol right in my forehead and say, I got to have your money. Where is it? There was a gal, Caroline, who had some money. They took it away from her. They took the geese and the chicken and all that was worth taking off the place, stripped it. Took all the meat out the smokehouse, corn out the crib, cattle out the pasture, burnt the gin house and cotton. When they left, they shoot some hogs and cows and left them lying right there. There was an awful smell around there for weeks. That's foraging, right? That's what it's on the history channel, foraging. It's pretty good, huh?
It is.
Here's one that's a little bit longer, but it's good. This is Henry D. Jenkins. A lot of these are coming from the middle of the state, obviously, because that's where the swath was at, when the army came through. He says, when the Yankees come, what they do? They did them things they ought not to have done and left undone those things who ought to have been done. Anybody's ever read a prayer book, you know, this comes from the epistle of prayer. Yes, that just about tells it. One thing you might like to hear, mistress got all the money, the silver, the gold, and the jewels, and got the well digger to hide them at the bottom of the well. The Yankees were smart. When they got there, they asked for the very things at the bottom of the well. Mistress wouldn't tell them. They held a court of inquiry in the yard, called the slaves up one by one, a good many. Must have been a Judas amongst us. Soon the Yankee was let down the well, and all the money, silver, gold, and jewels, watches, rings, brooches, knives and forks, butter dishes, water, goblets, and cups were took and carried away by the army that seemed more concerned about stealing than they was about the holy war for the liberation of the poor African slave people. They took off all the horses, sheep, chickens, geese, took the seine and the fishes, and caught corn in the crib, meat in the storehouse, and everything. Master General Sherman said war was hell. It sure was. Maybe it was hell for some of them Yankees when they come to die and give an account of the deeds they've done in Sumter and Richland counties. Smart man. Here's a good one for pro-union. So, he said Yankee soldiers came by the house at times, but they never bothered anybody at the place. Of course, they would take something to eat, but they never bothered anybody. This is in Spartanburg. So, this wasn't additional to Fairfield. But, you know, they're probably tired, out of matches, low on ammo. So I'm fair and balanced. There's one that I want to read. I'm just going to do one or two more, and then we'll get on with some other stuff. This cake is making me tired. Yeah, I like this one. Rosa Stark, near Winsboro, Fairfield County. She's 83 years old. The Yankees come and set all the cotton in the gin house fire, load up all the meats, take some of the sugar and shovel it over the yard. Take all the wine, rum, liquor, gut the house of all the silver and valuables, set it afire. Leave 1,000 niggers cold and hungry and our white folks in misery. They have never got over to the third generation, some of them. Some of them is the poorest white folks in the state today. I weeps when I see them so poor, but they is respectful yet, thank God. A publishing company that Dr. Clyde Wilson and I started about the time they took the flag down in Columbia, called Shotwell Publications. We just did the Kennedy Brothers book. It's called Punishment of Poverty. And when you talk about the third and fourth generation, they go into great detail about what happened to everyone here, black and white, who suffered the ravages of the purposeful and vengeful reconstruction and punishment afterwards, and keeping us in peonage with sharecropping and then later with millwork. That's good, you should check that. All right, I'm going to read this one, then we'll move on. Everybody okay?
Yes, sir.
All right, okay. I don't want to bore you. All right, Mary Wood. She was not happy. Not happy at all. When the Yankees come, I was sitting in the front yard. They ride up and say, "Where's your mistress?" I say, "I don't know." They said, "You was lying. Give her a few lashes and we will find out." Another say, "No, us come to free the niggas, not to whip them." Then they asked me for to tell them where the best things was hid. I say, "I don't know, sir." Then they ransack the house, bust open the smokehouse, take the meat, ham, shoulders, molasses, barrel, sugar, and meal, and put them on a four-horse wagon. Set the house, gin house, and barn afire, and go towards Rocky Mountain. I forgot to tell you that when the Yankees come and find me sitting in that swing, I had on a string of beads that Miss Nellie gave me. Them rascals, they took the beads off my neck. What you reckon they did with them? Well, if he doesn't know, I does. The scamps, one of them did, took my lovely beads and put them around the horse's neck and ride off with them, leaving me sobbing my life out on that swing. They say you must love your enemies and pray for them that despitefully use you, but I have never prayed for the Yankee scamp to this day. Although I am a Scotch, African, Irish, Associate, Reformed Presbyterian. She knew who she was, didn't she? The Spirit has never moved me to pray for that horse and rider that went off in my beat. That my mistress give me. When I tell Master William Woodsworth, my husband's old master, about it, he says, "The low-down, dirty stump, the Lord will take vengeance on him." Right, there's several more in here, but that gives you a flavor of the true history of the South. The true history of the South doesn't just include the Confederate our Confederate ancestors, although they were certainly an important part. The Southern people consist of all kinds of people, including those of African descent who were once in servitude, who suffered at the hands of the Yankees, just like we did, just like our people did, and of aftermath, just like we did. And while we don't want to brush under any sort of unpleasantnesses that did exist and have existed, I think it's safe to say that we have a common shared experience that is not really known because it's not useful to know it. Columbia doesn't need to know this. What would they do if they read from the slave narratives about the burning of Columbia? And there are some passages in here about Columbia. And that would ruin the whole damn program. Yeah? So now they did have two or three authors. Y'all probably had Tom Elmore out here. He had a little thing over at the library and a few other little things. But mostly, in the midst of remembering the burning, they never mentioned it. They thought about it at all.
So, I never knew that either. Yeah. Never. Until I read that.
So there's a lot of things that we don't know, and it's important that we know them. And not for any silly reason. It's because that, first of all, it's not important what people who don't care for us think about us, but it is important what we think of ourselves. It is important that we know our history, not so that we can defend it, or not so that we can fight with someone and show them how wrong they are, because when you put anybody in the corner, they snap out at you, and it doesn't matter whether they're right or wrong, it's human nature. But you need to know, because it'll give you courage. It'll give you courage to know that what you're doing here, what you're remembering here, what we're all doing here, is keeping alive the truth about something that right now is a horrible political brickbat that is used to beat us down and keep us quiet. And there's no reason for it. Our experience does not reflect the world that they think we live in or that we came from. Of course, there's a lot more first-hand accounts that are available, and their voices should be heard. This is just a few of them. And guess what? We don't need permission to tell their story. We don't need to be experts to understand what they say. We can acknowledge the complexity of human nature while seeing that these and other accounts are available to future generations. Not to prove that the Yankees are bad or prove the cause of our sires was good, but for us to understand our own history. We have nothing to hide, nothing at all. Our foundational understanding of these United States will not be threatened by the existence of accounts like those that we have just read. However, Lincoln is foundational to the American understanding of itself. The righteous motivation of Lincoln's invasion, freedom, equality, freeing the slaves, etc., is essential to their ability to justify the horrors of what was done and continues to be done today. Take that away, and they have real problems. We don't. So you can understand this is an ideological problem. Now, I'm not holding my breath for that day. Now, more importantly, their ignorance and arrogance is not my problem. And it's not yours either. So, in closing, I'd like to thank Mr. Dill for letting me pick on him and his assistance with the presentation. I'd like to thank the people that were interviewed in 36 and 37 for taking the time to speak to the people that came to their door. I wish that more had come to their door, and I wish it had happened earlier. But I'm thankful for what we have, because it puts a human face and gives a human voice to some of those that experienced the Yankee invasion in 1865. Here's the pitch. I have books over there for $5. I can mark them down real low. I know the boss. And you can read all these accounts in one sitting. There's not a lot to it. And I thank you all for your time and attention.